how beautiful you are.
You are. Children deserve love and protection from their mothers. But some women should never give birth.
Quiet!
It's very, very hard for people to understand how a mother could kill her children, but it happens.
A mom wants to possess her children at any cost.
It's by far the most shocking crime I've covered in my career.
A devout Christian mistakes delusions for divine messages.
And the voices were telling her that this was not a place for her children to be.
And a Philadelphia mom keeps lethal secrets for decades.
One death is horrible. A second death is suspicious. A third death is a crime.
When these deadly women snap, it results in the murder of innocence. The idyllic town of Skeen, Scotland.
Three kids.
Okay, three.
It's the new home to American couple Teresa and Pasquale Riggi.
They were the all-American couple who seemed to have it all. They moved because of his job to the United Kingdom in 1990, and thereafter, for a period of several years, were very happy, happily married couple.
They put down roots and start thinking about raising a family in Scotland.
So do you know what the success rate for IVF is?
But a natural pregnancy eludes them. They turn to IVF. It takes several years, but finally, in December 2001, the gift they want, twin boys. Friend Amber Siebold remembers the joy.
She seemed like a very loving mother, very kind and very together as well. She was always immaculate. Her children were always immaculate. You know, they were always well fed.
Teresa's besotted by her boys. She puts them before everyone else, even her husband.
Teresa immediately banished her husband from their marital bed and brought the babies into the bed and slept with them there.
Scotland and IVF turn out to be wonderfully fruitful for the Riggies. Pasquale is earning good money, and after 3 years, they have another child, daughter Cecilia. But Teresa's love for her children is starting to become an obsession.
Is this party next year?
She didn't let her children socialize with anybody around them, largely keeping them inside the house.
You want to have a princess party for your birthday?
TV reporter James Matthews discovered it wasn't just the children staying indoors.
She didn't engage with the outside world to any degree herself.
It's very nice of you to color that.
Mom, why can't we go to school like other kids?
Teresa didn't even trust the education department, insisting on homeschooling them.
You're much safer here with me.
She had talked about how she had had a hard time in high school, and that's why she wanted to homeschool her children.
They need to interact with other kids. Why can't you see that?
They're not going, and that's final.
Obsessed with her children, Teresa leaves her husband out in the cold.
I want a divorce.
Pasquale now has little sway in the household. The two parents drift apart.
She talked about, you know, their differences in sort of parenting from the beginning, and they just became her all as soon as they were there. So nobody else mattered anymore.
Finally, Pasquale has enough. He moves out of the family home. Teresa reacts badly, not because her husband leaves her, but he now has visitation with their children for 4 hours every week.
She was absolutely devastated. She just couldn't imagine even 4 hours a week without them.
Teresa Riggi had among other things, a paranoid personality.
No one is safe from Teresa's paranoia.
I had an Easter party at my house that her and the children came to. She had little sort of locator things.
Can we go now?
So if she couldn't see them, she would just press the button and it would beep. If they were out of her sight for a second, she would be, yeah, where are you? Austin, where are you?
Luke?
Just getting upset.
Look what I found!
Austin?
Putting electronic tags on the kids was an example of the crazy thinking that was going on in her head. That's an extreme thing to do to little kids.
Where have you been?
Just over there.
Well, that's not good enough. I told you to come straight back when you heard the beep.
Alarmed by this sort of behavior, Pasquale decides he has to act. He petitions for full custody of all three children. Teresa could soon lose everything, but she has no intention of letting that happen.
I just remember her saying, if he ever got custody of them, you know, he would never see them again, something along those lines. And what I really remember is her face, because it was like pure determination. You know, she wasn't gonna let that happen under any circumstances.
When California couple Teresa and Pasquale Righi first moved to Scotland, they wanted a family. And with some help from IVF, they now have one.
They need to interact with other kids. Why
but it's falling apart.
They're not going, and that's final.
Teresa's obsessed with her children and won't let them out of her sight.
You're so beautiful.
Pasquale has moved out, and he files for full custody. The war of the Righis is about to take a tragic turn.
She phoned Pasquale Righi at 11:30 at night.
Are you planning on taking the children away from me?
And asked him, are you trying to take my children away from me? His reply was, well, you've left me with no choice. And she said,
say goodbye then.
She hung up the phone.
On August 4th, 2010, Teresa takes family law into her own hands. Turning on 8-year-old Austin. Oh!
Oh! It is utterly shocking when you think about what these kids must have experienced, what they must have seen, and how desperate they must have felt. It is utterly horrific.
One by one, Teresa chases down her children.
They saw her coming. They tried to stop her. She probably chased them around the apartment. Each of them saw her doing this.
Each of the children was stabbed 8 times, mostly in the chest, but in other parts of their bodies, in the hands and on the arms. In killing the children, she used 3 different knives.
The last one to die saw their 2 siblings killed by her. One of the worst murder scenes I can think of.
There was blood everywhere in the house, in the bathroom, in the kitchen, at the breakfast bar, on the oven hob. It was a scene of carnage.
If Teresa couldn't have her children, nobody could.
I think there was anger and revenge at Pasquale involved in how she killed her children. You think I'm not serious? Watch this. You think you can take my children? Watch this. This is a very, very deadly woman.
But the senseless brutality isn't over. Teresa starts on herself.
Slashing her throat a number of times, stabbing herself in the chest and abdomen.
She's intent on dying with her children, but just can't seem to pull it off.
There were two separate ligatures hanging from the second floor landing, one a dressing gown cord, the other a pair of hair straighteners.
After unsuccessfully stabbing, then strangling herself, Teresa turns to fire.
She then started an explosion in the house by disconnecting the gas hob.
But still, Teresa is alive. She resorts to the apartment balcony.
She was seen to climb on the railing by neighbors, swayed for around a minute, shouted, "I can't believe what's happening to me."
My children!
Don't jump!
Oh, God!
And then threw herself off that second floor balcony.
But a car breaks her fall. Teresa is rushed to the hospital and survives. The small Scottish town of Skeen is in disbelief. The family that kept to themselves has been decimated.
To think about what that must have been like for them at their age, trying to understand why their mother, who they loved with all their hearts, was hurting them so badly. I can't begin to wrap my head around that.
Teresa never planned to answer for her crimes. She thought she'd be dead.
Number one, she was diagnosed as being narcissistic. Number two, she was diagnosed as being paranoid. And number three, she was diagnosed with histrionic personality disorder. This is a condition in where the person thrives on extreme drama.
Despite the diagnosis, Scottish authorities deem Teresa competent to stand trial. She pleads guilty to three counts of culpable murder and is sentenced to 16 years.
I think it wasn't long enough what she was sentenced to, because it wasn't even the sum total of how long they had lived.
Teresa thought of her children as possessions, who she would rather destroy than share. She leaves a stricken husband and a community in shock. All Teresa has now are her deadly deeds.
Teresa Ruggie has never expressed any remorse. Psychiatrists who have examined her say that she continues to believe that God was calling her and her children home.
What Teresa wanted was to make her husband pay and suffer the rest of his life over what she did. And making her husband suffer was more important than the life she had created.
When a mother hears deleted messages.
This was a very ugly world, that this was not a place for her children to be.
About what's best for her children.
She thought she was doing something good for her children.
The unthinkable can happen.
The voices tell the person horrible things about themselves, and it can make the individual very, very dangerous to other people.
Setting the right example is important to Milwaukee mom Elise Ladvina. In 1997, she runs a strict household, bringing up her two sons, Joe, 9, and John Jr. 8 to obey their parents and the Lord. May the Lord make
us. Her faith was probably the cornerstone of her life. She was devoutly religious, and she raised her children to be religious as well.
34-year-old Elise and her accountant husband, John, are respected and active members of their church community.
They were heavily involved in the church. She was on church committees. She was a volunteer at church. She sang in the choir. She was known at the Catholic school where her sons, you know, went as a good mother.
Father.
But all is not as it seems. Elise has a dark secret. She is a troubled soul who hears voices.
Elise heard voices in her head, known as auditory hallucinations. That type of hallucination, voices, they're not fun, they're not kind. The voices tell the person horrible things about themselves and sometimes about other people.
And the voices have a grim message for Elise.
Her delusion was that she was a bad mother. She was psychotic.
Elise believes the power of prayer will solve her problems. But faith alone can't help. She's suffering from a serious mental illness, schizophrenia.
Schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorder, thought disorders, generally emerge when the individual is in their late teens to early to mid-20s. Elise appeared completely normal until she was in her mid-20s. And then the psychoses took over.
When Elise's illness starts in the early 1990s, her concerned family insist she get medical help.
Her struggles with mental illness became more visibly apparent. There was a brief hospitalization. She was seeing a psychiatrist, diagnosed with a socioaffective disorder, was placed on antipsychotic medication. Medication was clearly critical in order for her to function in society and to not be delusional.
But Elise doesn't trust the medication. She has more faith in the voices than pills.
Part of the nature of the illness schizophrenia is that the patient is suspicious of medication. They think it's poison. They become paranoid about the medication, and that's one of the reasons they don't want to take it.
Elise's husband, John, does everything he can to support his wife.
Friends and neighbors reported that they thought Elise was perfectly normal. And there were some days I'm sure she probably did come across that way. Her own husband didn't know how really sick she was.
Please, I promise it'll...
Boys, hey, go back the car, okay?
Without her medication, her behavior becomes so erratic by 1994 that John decides he must leave Elise for his son's sake.
Please, John, please.
For a time, the boys had gone to live with their grandparents because of their mother's instability. So there were obviously signs of great trouble within the family and within the home.
But marriage is a sacred vow. And after a year living apart, the devout Christians try again.
Are you taking your pills?
And Elise is taking her pills.
I'm about to take one of your pills.
After they reunite, they had a couple of good years where it looked like the medication was working, the treatment was working, and that they would be a successful family after all.
But soon Elise stops her meds, and the voices are back.
Lord, I prayed.
These are very, very strong medications that do help, but they don't work if they're left in the bathroom. The meds have to be taken every day.
But when this mom's not taking her pills, bad things will happen.
Elise did not have a history of violence. She did not have a history of outbursts or anything that would indicate what would happen next.
Don't listen to you. I don't listen.
I'll try not to be.
Milwaukee couple, Elise and John Levina, seem to have a good life with their two sons. The committed Christians are pillars of their local church. But Elise is fighting her own demons, schizophrenia. She stops taking her medication, and her delusions return.
Elise didn't want to take the medication. She didn't like the way it made her feel. And this is typical of a lot of schizophrenics. They start taking the medication, and then they think, well, I'm well now. I don't need to take it.
I can hear you.
The voices are more controlling.
I can hear you.
And their message more chilling.
And the voices were telling her that this was a very ugly world, that this was not a place for her children to be. So she's thinking about that, she's hearing these voices, and she's making a plan.
August 26th, 1997. Elise washes up after the evening meal. Her two boys have gone their separate ways. 8-year-old John Jr. plugs into his asthma treatment machine in the basement. 9-year-old Joe retires to his room.
This was an idyllic scene. It was sort of at first this normal middle American summer evening.
But it's not. Elise believes she's receiving divine messages.
Her religious faith spun into delusions at the time of the murder.
Elise's delusion was that she had to kill the children so their souls would go to heaven. Apparently, her delusion also told her she needed to do it with a baseball bat.
The most vulnerable child, little John, is attacked first.
That 8-year-old boy probably never saw what was coming. He was taking his treatment when his mother came in there and started swinging that bat. He really didn't have a chance.
Elise?
The father hears thumping sounds coming from the basement. He has to take time to rush in, and she's still hitting her son with the bat.
Elise! What are you doing? Oh, God!
He takes that bat from her, holds her down.
Struggling to hold on to his wife, John calls for help.
While he was calling 911, she took the bat and rushed upstairs and started attacking her second son, Joe. Who would think, you know, your mother, who had just prepared dinner for you, would suddenly try to murder you with a baseball bat? It doesn't get more horrific than that.
For Elise, beating the boys with a baseball bat was a way to dispatch them to heaven. The blood didn't matter.
This time, John manages to stop his wife. Both boys are rushed to the hospital. 8-year-old John Jr. can't be saved. He dies of skull fractures.
He would have lost consciousness very rapidly. Death would have taken a matter of minutes after that. In all likelihood, he would have been dead 10 or 15 minutes later.
Miraculously, 9-year-old Joe survives. His father's actions save his life.
His father made it upstairs in time and was able to wrestle his wife off of the boy.
Fortunately, her second son did not receive as many blows as her first son. He probably only received 2 or 3, maybe 4 blows, enough to cause skull fracture and some underlying brain injury.
There is no question about who commits these crimes. Police arrest Elise at the scene.
She was immediately charged with the most serious offenses under Wisconsin law, first-degree intentional homicide and attempt of first-degree intentional homicide.
For what we are about to receive.
Elise offers a shocking explanation as to why she attacks her sons.
She thought they would be better off because she couldn't provide them with a good life in this society because it was too twisted and the bad influences of television and so forth. So she thought she was doing something good for her children by murdering them.
It's not unusual for people suffering with certain types of schizophrenia to believe that God is talking to them. It's known as religious ideation, and it can make the individual very, very dangerous to other people.
Elise is found criminally insane and is committed to a mental institution.
This is one of those tragic cases. She was a woman who actually loved her children, and her mental illness drove her to do the unthinkable.
In 2007, after being committed for 10 years, she is released on the condition she never contacts her former family.
She was ordered by the judge to never have contact with John Ledvina, and she was also ordered to have no contact with her surviving son. And there was a termination of her parental rights.
The court hears testimony from prominent psychiatrists that now Elise is medicated. She's stable. Her dangerous religious delusions, a thing of the past. But not everyone thinks justice has been served.
As a member of the community, I'm disturbed that Elise Ledvina got out. And I think anyone who's capable of murdering their own child is always going to be, in some level, a threat to society. I think this is the most cold-hearted crime that could be committed for a mother who brings a child into this world to be capable of murdering that child, and in such a heinous manner.
Some psychologists and psychiatrists would say that society is safe from Elise. Maybe they're right, and maybe they're wrong. But I would not let Elise babysit for me.
Having a family is one of life's greatest thrills.
She had baby after baby after baby.
For most new parents,
they observe how distant Marino was.
But not in this house.
One death is horrible. A second death is suspicious.
Shut up!
A third death is a crime.
Imagine going blind overnight. In 1949, it happened to 20-year-old Philadelphia wife, Marie Noe. Her husband, Arthur, rushes her to the hospital.
They're, of course, very freaked out, and they're trying to figure out what's going on because they see there's no physical reason for her to be blind.
The doctors conclude Marie's blindness is caused by severe emotional stress.
Marie suffered what is known as hysterical blindness. She would really become blind and not be able to see. But it was psychologically induced, a psychosomatic reaction to stress.
It should be the happiest time of her life. 6 weeks earlier, Marie gives birth to their first child, Richard. But caring for a newborn is a struggle for the first-time mom.
There were issues with vomiting, there were issues with underweight, there were issues with feeding. She had a hard time feeding her kids. She got very frustrated when they wouldn't eat.
Things go from difficult to heartbreaking. Arthur returns home from work on April 7th to discover Richard's still body in his crib.
Marie, he's not breathing!
Only lived for 31 days. A determination was made by the hospital that he died from congestive heart failure.
Losing a child is a parent's worst nightmare. Doctors believe the psychological trauma brings on Marie's blindness.
So they go through this incredible experience. They have a baby, they lose a baby, then she goes blind. Then they have to treat her for that. But they want to have other kids, so they move on.
Marie's vision soon returns, and 18 months later, the couple is blessed with a second child, a healthy little girl, Elizabeth. Arthur is delighted. Having a family is his dream. But Marie still finds motherhood difficult.
Marie Noe was a simple-minded, uneducated, probably an immature adult. I believe she was unable to be a mother.
When baby Elizabeth becomes ill, Marie makes frantic calls for help.
When Elizabeth was 5 months old, Marie started having interactions with doctors and hospitals again.
Please, I need some help.
She claimed that she found her vomiting blood.
Blood everywhere.
And during a course of a number of backs and forth with the doctor, she was found and brought dead to a hospital.
The death of her babies is too much for Marie. She seeks counsel from her priest.
She wanted to get her tubes tied.
I just don't want to lose another baby.
I know.
She was about to do it, and she went to see her priest, and her priest told her it would be a sin.
A mortal sin.
So she didn't do it.
The church wouldn't allow it. So instead, she had baby after baby after baby.
Marie is very fertile. In the next 12 years, she gives birth to six more children. Two are stillborn, but the other four, three girls and a boy, are in good health when they leave the hospital. But Marie's never a mother for long. One after the other, her babies die.
People were sympathetic to them. I don't think there was any suspicion at all at that point that any of them had anything to do with this, that it was just what happened.
But one person is suspicious. The new medical examiner.
She specialized in pediatric forensic work. And she was the first one to do one of the autopsies and question what was going on here.
Marie Noe was always alone when these deaths occurred. She always indicated that she either found the baby in the crib or the playpen. The bottom line in each of these deaths was it was an unexplained death.
Without any real evidence, the authorities' hands are tied. And Marie soon gives birth to her ninth baby, Catherine. Concerned doctors take drastic action. The little girl isn't sick, but they keep her in the hospital for months, where nurses can keep a close eye on Catherine and her mother.
They observed lots of things about the nose in terms of how distant Marie Noe was.
And Marie's baby talk is chilling.
One of the nurses said that she watched her having trouble feeding and put in the chart that she said,
"Eat this or I'll kill you."
But a healthy baby can't be nursed forever. When Catherine is 3 months old, Marie is allowed to take her home. But doctors fear for her future.
One of the doctors wrote, "I hope she lives long enough to grow her fingernails long enough to fight her off." So, I mean, there's real drama here, and everybody is afraid something bad's going to happen.
Philadelphia couple, Marie and Arthur Noe, seem cursed. Starting in 1949, Marie gives birth to 8 children. They all die before they can crawl.
Eat this or I'll kill you.
Doctors keep her 9th child, Catherine, in the hospital for 3 months. But Catherine isn't sick, and reluctantly they allow Marie to take her home.
The doctors and nurses were on to her, and yet there was nothing they could really do to prevent the child from going home.
Marie has borne many children, but she's no mother. She can't cope with Catherine and constantly calls her doctor for guidance. Marie's stories become more outlandish.
One day, I think at 8 months, Marie tells this crazy story.
She must have pulled up one of Art's suits.
The baby stopped breathing because she pulled a dry cleaning bag off a hanger and it almost asphyxiated her.
Catherine survives the incident, but doesn't live for long. On the morning of February 25th, 1966, she's home alone with mom when she dies in her crib.
She lived for 14 months. She was a real kid. People knew her, people played with her, the family got to know her.
The news devastates the hospital staff that tried so hard to protect Catherine.
It was heartbreaking for everybody when they were unable to save her. And by that time, her death did trigger the first real investigation. Within hours, the investigators from the medical examiner's office were there to interview the Noes as if they were possible suspects.
But investigators can't find any sign of foul play, and no charges are filed. Catherine's death is put down to a tragic reality of the times.
No one had the slightest idea why kids died at that time. It was all speculation. The rules for how kids died were being changed like every week.
The following year, the unthinkable happens. Marie gives birth to baby number 10, Arthur Jr.
Obviously, everybody was scared to death by this point. They were under investigation. They didn't know how suspected they were by this point. And so again, the baby was kept in the hospital for a really long time, as long as they could.
Medical staff are shocked that Marie and Arthur only visit their son twice in the hospital.
It's no surprise to me that when Marie and Art's last child was hospitalized for 3 months, that Marie only visited twice. Marie never wanted to be a mother.
Only weeks after baby Arthur goes home, the cycle of near-death incidents begin.
The reasons why the babies weren't breathing were getting sort of more and more ridiculous. The family cat had smothered the baby's face, and so she had to bring the baby in because that's why the baby wasn't breathing. That's almost like a joke.
But Arthur's death is no laughing matter. He passes away on January 2nd, 1968.
Again, the minute he died, the medical examiner's office was again investigating this case.
Quiet!
But the investigation goes nowhere and is dropped. For 30 years, the deaths remain a mystery until journalist Stephen Freed hears of a very similar case of baby deaths that was proven to be murder. He starts digging into Marie's life.
When we were trying to convince people why this 30-year-old case should be reopened, the only explanation for it was that 8 kids had died without any justice.
The case is reopened, and in the 1990s, a lot more is known about the psychological makeup of mothers who kill. Marie Noe fits their profile to a T.
She was a woman indicative of many of the traits of people that commit infanticide. Primitive, psychologically inept person who couldn't be a mother and decided to end the lives of her children. One death is horrible. A second death is suspicious. A third death is a crime. All these deaths, the eight, were as a result of suffocation by Marino.
There are probably several reasons why Marie didn't come under suspicion for murdering her children for a very long time. One of them is the last thing anyone wants to think is that a mother would kill their own innocent, defenseless baby.
So tell me, Marie, how did you do it?
With Kershaw.
All of them?
I think so. I can't remember them all.
When prosecutors finally catch up with Marie, she is 70 years old. To everyone's surprise, she quickly confesses.
After she was confronted with a determination made by the medical examiner, she said, yes, I did commit these crimes.
Marie may have admitted the murders after getting away with it for so long, because they say confession is good for the soul.
50 years after the murder of her first child, Marie Ngo is brought to justice, but she won't go to jail. She is sentenced to 5 years house arrest and 20 years probation on the condition she lets mental health experts examine her to learn more about infanticide. Her devoted husband, Arthur, still doesn't believe she's guilty.
He made it very clear that he never would have stayed with somebody for all that time if he had the slightest doubt.
I can understand that love is blind, but I also understand that for Art to really admit to himself that his wife murdered their children would have been an unbearable truth.
Eat this or I'll kill you.
These deadly women brought life into the world and then took it away.
Austin?
Teresa Riggi thought her children Celia? Were possessions. Elise Ledvina gave in to the voices in her head. And Marie Ngo could make babies, but couldn't care for them. All three women destroyed the precious bond between mother and child. It was the murder of innocence.